Annika Rice and Jeremy Beadle are this week's guests on Celebrity Shoe Swap, a new series where celebrities with similar-sized feet exchange footwear for your entertainment. That's at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Up next, another interview with 80s Nostalgia. This week's guest is the actor best known as Traegard from Nightmare, Hugo Myatt.
Were you studious at school?
Oh no, it was a total flop. I spent my whole time staring out of the window, living in my imagination. Absolutely useless. If school was the happiest days of my life, I've got misery to look forward to. I couldn't wait to get out, I'm afraid. But I really was a dreamer. I think one of the things about actors or writers is that basically you want to live in your imagination. And so having actually to do things, real things like maths and, you know, chemistry or something is terrible. There was a jolly good view out of the window, which I was constantly being shouted at not to be looking out of, yeah.
A lot of the work that you do is voice related. Did radio or music feature a lot in your early life as well?
Radio did. I mean, first my father actually worked for BBC Radio. He was a news editor. So the radio was it in our house as a child. News bulletins were heard on the hour, every hour, more or less, if he was at home. So I was rather brought up on radio. And later on, of course, all the light programs, variety shows and comedy shows and so on and so forth. So yes, television didn't feature in my life, long past everyone else having it. I suppose into my late teens, we didn't really have television. I'm prehistoric, you see.
Did you know quite early on what you wanted to do? Because I believe your first jobs weren't related to being in the media or being performing as such.
No, not at all. I mean, the trouble is you have to sort of go back in history. But my father, and I presume my mother as well, although my father was 20 years older than my mother, had been around long before. My father was, let's put it straight, my father was born in 1897. Does that make sense to anybody today? It doesn't seem possible, does it? Yeah, and my mother was 20 years younger. But of course, they'd lived through the 20s and 30s, and the 30s being the Great Depression. He didn't really change his attitudes very much. So he fathered three boys, my brothers and myself. And the thing was, you had to get a job, you know. It was very important that you had a job. Preferably a career, but if not, a job. And so when I left school, I was rather sort of forced to go to find myself a job. And I got a job in the city of London in a shipping company, which sort of quite pleased the parents because that sounded respectable, you know, going up to the city every day. I was absolutely dire at it. I mean, I was ghastly. And I didn't last very, very long. The only thing about it was I quite enjoyed was that I worked for the fueling department, which in shipping terms is called bunkering. The great thing about bunkering is when the phone rings, you can pick up the phone and say, bunkering, which kind of shocks people at the other end. You know. But that didn't last long. And then I got a job at the National Coal Board Open Cast Executive as something to do with personnel. I was dreadful at that as well. I just used to walk around with a clipboard and a piece of paper on it, trying to avoid work of any sort. The interesting thing about both these things, the original company, the shipping company, was Element Lines, and the next job was with the National Coal Board, neither of these organisations exist anymore. And I wonder if that's anything down to me. So, anyway, from there, I just hated it all. I just wanted to... I can't remember doing anything very much in the way of amateur dramatics. I did one sort of, joined one amateur group and did one play as far as I remember. But I had this great urge to be an actor for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And I saw an advert in the paper for a children's theatre, which was long before they thought up theatre of education. It wasn't posh at all. It was light work done with penny and trap, really. And we went to schools and charged £2 a head or something like that, I think it was. It was a pretty piratical organization. But anyway, I got a job with them. And that's how I started in theater, touring the country. I think it was a converted ambulance, and it had black windows, so we couldn't see out, except at the windscreen, of course. and we toured around. I think the first company I was in, I think there were four of us or five of us, I can't remember now. And we had a few bits of costume and a few rostrums and stuff we could put up and lights, and went and did various shows. I remember Toad of Toad Hall being one. We did an adaptation of Midsummer Night's Dream, pretty poorly, I think. I don't know. I can't remember them all now. So, I mean, it's 50 years ago.
Only got into acting maybe in the mid-60s or so.
Yes. I'm trying to think exactly when. It probably was, yes, yes. So it was exactly mid-60s, yeah, 65, 66, something like that.
And you've got an instantly recognisable voice. Is that something that you've worked on?
No, it's not. People, I felt rather embarrassed. You know, other actors have come up to me and say, well, oh, you must have done a lot of work on your voice. And I thought, well, no, I haven't. I can only put it down to when I was a child, I was drafted into the local church choir, and we were very lucky that we had a choir master who was some professional professor of music, particularly church music. His name was Frederick Durrant. He had a great reputation. He also ran professional choirs, and this was his hobby, this little parish church choir. But he was very, very good at teaching breathing. I mean, I'm not a great singer or anything, but breathing and voice. And I suspect that's where I learned anything I learned. I was not particularly aware of it, because when you're a kid, you just go along with these things and do it. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed singing oratorio and all this stuff we did. So I can only put it down to that, really.
And if my research is correct, you've been in around 170, 180 plays or so. Is that right? That's a huge amount.
200. I know it's about 200 plays. And I directed about 50 over the years. But you see, I got into weekly rep, you see, initially, after doing, I did a couple of tours and a couple of other things, then I got into weekly rep, and I loved weekly rep, which is when you're rehearsing one play in the day and playing another at night, and you have to learn the thing incredibly quickly. I mean, most sort of plays of that sort are about 2 hours, some are longer, 2.5 hours, usually made up of three acts. So when you're doing weekly rep, you have to learn an act of a play a night, you know, as well as doing a show in the evening. So, it's very intense. And you get to the point where you don't pick up a newspaper, you start learning it. You even avoid street names after a bit. But it's very good training, and I enjoyed it so much. I probably did it for far too long, but I did enjoy it. So that's how I've probably got so many plays on my CV. You know, I did all these many, many plays in weekly rep.
It does sound relentless, having to learn a play while you're performing one. Do you have a good memory?
I never thought so, but people said I did. I used to do a thing which I reckon was osmosis. You know, you lie on the bed at night, you start learning, and then you realise you've got to go to sleep, so you put the copy of the script under the pillow, and the morning you woke up and you thought, oh, I know that now.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, I don't really know how it worked, but as somebody said, the great inspiration of learning lines is fear, because you're the one who's going to look an absolute idiot when you get halfway through the scene and you can't think what comes next. So you do learn it. Odd. I mean, I talk to amateurs and they say, oh, you know, we've only had 6 weeks to learn this play, and I think, you have never been born, mate. You've never been born.
I used to work in a little theatre myself for about eight or nine years or so, and the amount of dedication people had for learning things. I was not an actor. I've never acted in my life. I did the sound and light, so I'm more of a technical person. But the amount of dedication actors have is amazing.
Well, they're funny creatures, actors. What does it say in the producers? Milo says, have you ever eaten with them? Not madly responsible as a breed, but yes, quite dedicated to their craft.
And which have been your favourite roles to play?
I knew you were going to ask me this, and I don't know. I mean, some plays used to follow me around. I did Educating Rita with various Ritas, and it's a brilliant play, and it's great fun to do, and I did love that. I actually, I suppose the most well-known was Sarah Lancashire. I did Educating Rita with her at one point, but I did it with several other actresses at different times, and they were all very good. And there's a wonderful drunk scene in it for Frank, which is great fun to play, because the great thing about playing drunks is, of course, not being drunk, is trying not to be drunk, as you watch people in pubs trying not to be drunk when they obviously are. And that's the key to playing a drunk scene. And that makes it great fun.
And you directed a lot of plays as well. How did you make the transition from being an actor to a director?
It was simple, really. I was in a company, and the director and producer of the company said to me, Hugo, yes. Well, you're directing the next play. I said, oh, right. Ah, yes. Okay. So that's how it started, really. Simple as that.
And which do you prefer? Do you like the idea of telling people what to do, or do you like the idea of being in control of a character?
Well, you don't really tell people what to do as a director, but let me put it another way. There's one great advantage, you don't have to learn the lines. But you see, what director really is there is to make sure everybody's in the same play. That might sound silly, but one thing you can't do as an actor is see the whole thing. You know, you can only see your part and your interaction with whoever you're dealing with that particular time. So the directors, this is my idea about directing, anyway. The director is out there to be, if you like, the audience and to see how it all fits together. There's quite a lot of things you have to consider. Simple things like one actor not masking the other or people not falling over the furniture or stuff like that. But actors, bless them, you know, they get a part. They read the play. If you're lucky, they read the whole play. And then they learn their own part. But of course, if they don't actually... Or they're not really immersed in the play because they're so bothered about learning their own part. They're likely not to always understand what something refers to or the way it should be referred to, because you have to go back to scene one, which they weren't in. Do you see what I mean? So he's there really to bring the whole thing together and make it work. Oh, there are other things as well. I mean, you know, some directors want to stamp their mark on it, and some want to have outlandish ideas. We'll all do this in the nude with tin pots on our heads or something, which I've never really thought very much of. But then I'm a working director. I'm not somebody who's a great artistic director who comes up with brilliant things. I just the thing is, I found, which was quite a surprise to me, is that having been an actor for quite a long time, I found that actors quite like me directing them, because you see, actors are like people, surprisingly, and there's certain things they're inhibited about, different for every other actor, and some things they're embarrassed about, and like all of us, you know, there's some things that they don't like doing or don't like being seen to, you know, all that stuff. So you've got to be a bit tactful and try and overcome any problems of that nature. So there's a bit of I don't know, social services about it as well.
Yeah, I always imagine it's the kind of role where you need to adapt and you need to direct different people in different ways. It's quite a unique one-on-one experience in some ways, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, some actors are very bravura and some are very sort of almost timid and shy. So sometimes you have to pull them back and sometimes you have to bring them forwards. It all depends. It's quite interesting. I find it fascinating, but that's what I did.
So I need to move on to Nightmare, because Nightmare was a fundamental part of my childhood. So Nightmare itself was an idea that Tim Child came up with.
Yes, Tim, the brilliant Tim. The whole concept was Tim's, and he controlled it too, because he needed to. How should we start with this? I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I just knew that Tim was a great games player. I think I've probably said this many times. And not just computer games, I mean every sort of game, from chess to whatever, you know. But with the computer game thing, I think he I don't know, he's never told me this, but I've always thought he was still outside the game, you know, because you're outside on a keyboard or whatever you're doing or whatever it is nowadays they use. But you're not actually in it. I think his desire was to get inside the game, to be actually in it. And that's how this whole thing came about, you know, to actually put somebody in the game. And it was brilliant, I think.
How did you come to be involved in it? Did he invite you for an audition?
No, it's quite a long story, really, but I'll cut it down because it'll take too long to tell. But fundamentally, I did know Tim slightly because I was living in Norfolk at that time, and I had done, incidentally, Nightmare was made at Anglia Television in Norwich, so that hence Norfolk. I was living in Norfolk at the time and working. I had an old boat in a boatyard on the hard, you know, out of the water. And I was working, putting planks in or something. And I knew Tim slightly because I'd done various bits at Anglia Television. And he had a boat next door, and he said to me, Hugo, you're an actor, aren't you? He said, I'm making a pilot, a television pilot. He said, It's only a quarter of an hour. It won't be shown or anything. It's just to work out. We've just got this idea for this sort of program. We just want to work out the sort of practicalities of it and whether it's possible. Would you be interested? And here's sort of a few quid in your pocket, you know. So I said, yes. He said, right, we'll meet in a pub and I'll explain it all to you. We duly met in a pub. And he did explain it all to me and kept saying to me, got it? Yes. Right? Understand? I said, yes, yes, yes. Truth is, I didn't understand a single word he was saying. But being an actor, you know, if somebody says, can you abseil? You say, oh, yes. You know, you just do it whether you... Anyway, so we did this little pilot, and I gradually got an idea of what the thing was about. I wasn't totally into it, but and forgot about it. And then about two or three months later, he called me up and said, "Yeah, Hugo, we've got we're doing a full length pilot, half an hour pilot." Anyway, he said it won't be shown. Of course, it's just to make sure the whole thing really does come together with a thing. If you bob me a hand, you interested? So I said, "Yes, terrific." So we did that pilot, and that was great. But I thought that would be the end of it because, in my experience, usually with anything like this, any pilots you do, or you know, actors often get called in to do pilots of one show or another, and the usual thing that happens is that once it's, if it is accepted and they're going to show it, they'll get some name or famous actor or somebody recognisable to play the part that you did in the pilot. So I assumed that was the end of it. And then eventually... I got a call, might have been some months later, I can't remember, and Tim called and said, Hugo, we've got a series. I said, oh, great, great, Tim, terrific. Well, good luck with it. He said, no, we've got a series, you and I. So that was lovely, yeah, that's how it happened.
And was the pilot different to the end product? Or was it the same, exact same principle, exact same layout?
It's sort of the layout was. I mean, but then, of course, Tim had to go away and really, you know, write a series. So he it obviously got much more sophisticated, I think is what you'd say, than the pilot was. And had a lot of different characters. I mean, over the whole run of 8 years, we had 31 different actors and actresses performing with the Dungeoneer, you know, in various roles. So a lot of that, of course, had to be worked out and written. When I say written, I don't mean actually scripts so much as given scenarios, you know. So that was quite a lot for Tim. And that was all down to Tim. He did it all.
Most TV shows have things like sets. So was it not a bit disturbing when you walk into Anglia and you see it's just like a blue screen?
Well, I didn't, of course. I mean, where I was an actual set. So that was known as the live set. And there were two actual blue, which we call voids, two, I don't call them sets. So no, I mean, and of course the poor child who went into the blue void couldn't see anything anyway. So it wasn't all that bothersome, except for the fact he probably was more bothered about not being able to see anything, you know. What actually happened was the children never, ever saw us off set. And of course, the Dungeoneer didn't see anyone in his sets. So the children, particularly the Dungeoneer, they never saw us before, after, or during, except actually on set. So when that poor child came through the door and I said, "Enter, stranger," the poor thing had never seen me before. So they were quite sometimes shaking, you know, seeing actually shaking. Which sounds terribly cruel, but within a few minutes they'd forgotten all that and they were into the game. And then, of course, I'd put a helmet on. The poor thing couldn't see anything, turned him around, pushed him out and said, "The only way is onward, and there is no turning back," and I've scared the living daylights out of him again. So with the three advisors, we're basically watching a monitor. It was dressed up as various things, and it was quite large, so they could see really what was going on. And that's all I could see, their monitor. I didn't have one for myself or anything else. That was what I could see. Now, once the Dungeoneer got into the blue void, there he is, helmet on, all he can see is a little bit of a circle of blue around his feet. That's all he can see. I mean, some of them tried to cheat. They kept lifting the helmet up, you know, but of course you still only see blue, so it's a waste of time. Now, once you've got them interacting with the character, it was all improvised because the character had no idea what the Dungeoneer was going to say. And what the character had to do was to try to get them to where they were supposed to go or blow them out if they were incapable of getting there. So you see that whole scene is improvised. So every single one of those scenes with another character in the void was improvised. Isn't that brilliant?
It is, yeah. I assume they got given guidelines.
Oh, yeah, they had a sort of scenario. And they might have had a few lines if they were essential for, you know, some particular reason, like a spell or something. But The point was that a lot of people don't appreciate this. Although it was recorded, we actually did it as though it were live, which means there were no retakes and no rehearsals. Because if we'd had any retakes or rehearsals, it wouldn't have been a game, it wouldn't have been a competition, it wouldn't have been a quest. So from our point of view, everything was as though live. So there's poor characters in the void with the Dungeoneer. I had to improvise the whole thing. All 31 of them. I don't remember any one of them ever screwing up, which I think is incredible. And we didn't lose any Dungeoneers either. There's a myth going around. There's still people saying, where's our little, you know, Freddy gone, you know? But it's not true. They all went home safely.
Oh, that's a relief. Were you allowed to help teams out at your discretion?
The thing developed over time, so that initially, I can't remember how many series, two or three series, maybe even more than that, I had to provide the menace as well as the sort of avuncular help, because there was no villain. So it was quite a difficult role to do, because I had to keep the sort of the sense of peril going. But at the same time, you don't want, in terms of television values and the audience at home, you don't want people to come on and then 30 seconds later they're off, they're out, they're done it. You know? So in the first few rooms, as we call them, I would try and help, if necessary, just to keep them going. But you see, you get teams that, again, it's television. You've got to remember it's television. And there are different values, television production values and television values, televisual values, I suppose you should say. And sometimes you get teams who are full of life and you know, jolly and everything, but they weren't terribly good games players. So you don't want them to blow out straight away. So I'd try and help along a bit. And then others who were absolute nerds, I mean, lovely, but nerds, you know, they just knew exactly what they were doing. So I step left, move three steps forward, turn, you know, but they're not terribly good value in television terms. So we try to put something in to liven them up and to make them more sort of physical, expressive, whatever. So what used to happen, I had an earpiece from the director, from Tim usually, a talkback, and I'd hear this, Hugo, we're putting in Gatwick. Now, Gatwick was our code name for the Corridor of Blades, which would, you know, that would liven up anybody. Because not only do they have to think about it, they have to jump from right to left, up and down, heaven knows what. Otherwise, they get chopped up. I'm not sure that I think we might have chopped up one person. I can't remember. I don't think we chopped up many. But it did liven them up. So you see what I mean? So teams are very different.
Did you find any teams found it too hard? Like, as you go through the entire introduction process of welcoming them to the dungeon, sitting them all down, talking them through what they have to do, and then within the first room, they just die.
No, I think you've got to remember there was an audition process, of which I actually know very little because I wasn't there. But I gather that the way they recruited these teams, they went to local radio stations and local press and then had a series of auditions all around the country where they sort of played the game. So I think they were very careful in selecting the teams. The interesting thing is that it's quite difficult to get a team of four. Everyone has two mates at school or whatever. But sometimes the fourth one, it was quite obvious, was not really one of their chums. It was somebody they sort of grabbed and said, you know, like this sort of, I can't think what it's called, press gang, the fourth one. Now, the other trouble was that the brightest one, who's usually the one who organized it all, got them all together, the brightest one always insisted on going under the helmet, which, if you think about it logically, is the worst thing to do, because you're just told to go left, right, whatever, whatever. But they always did. We couldn't ever persuade them not to. And the other thing, of course, Mum back at home wanted to see little Johnny on the telly. All she saw was a bucket on somebody's head, you know, which is not what Mummy wanted to see. So there you go. But anyway, that's the way it worked out.
They must have thought that they're having that full experience by wearing that helmet. They must have thought that being immersed, that must have been the appeal for it.
I don't think it actually harmed them at all. I think they had a good game. But in terms of working out what to do, I mean, some of these visual puzzles, they really had no choice, no input to. I mean, floors dropping away and things like that. You know.
And where did Traegard's catchphrases come from?
Well, they weren't meant to be, any of them. I suppose the famous is Ooh Nasty, and I actually, well, I'll tell you how that happened. When we first started bumping children off or whatever, we used to drop them from a great height. There was often, you know, floor tile would disappear and they'd go down. And the next thing we had on screen was actually a sort of animation, really, of a body sort of dropping from a huge height down. And that took quite a long time, that just to watch that thing. So I thought I ought to cover it. So I said, "Ooh, nasty," to cover it. So and that happened a few times in the early series. But I gathered there were sort of complaints that people didn't really like us dropping children from precipices to their destiny, you know. And so we dropped the animation, but I still got the "Ooh, nasty" when anybody copped out, you know. That was it. So that's how that came about. I don't know whether there were any others. Apparently Warning Team, which I suppose that was me. I was just trying to think of something to say when I saw they were obviously going in the wrong direction or not listening. And frequently they didn't always listen because they talked over each other the whole time, so it was quite difficult for them to listen. Sometimes they'd be a sort of a goblin horn or something, and I'd say, "Warning Team." But then the other thing is that sometimes I would get from the team getting very excited and not knowing what to do, and I'd hear from over my earpiece, and Tim would say, "Hugo, do something." Well, that's not a great deal of help, Tim. And, of course, you can't answer back, and you can't even show that you've been spoken to because you're on camera the whole time. So I'd start speaking very slowly. I'd go, "Team, have you perhaps considered whether you should?" Because I'm just trying to think of something to say, you know. And certainly towards the last series, I mean, there was, I thought I knew the answers to everything, but in one of the, I remember once a riddle coming up and watching the kids and suddenly realizing, I don't know the answer to this. What if they ask me? I'm going to be in real difficulty here. So, yeah, it was tough. It was a tough game. Tough.
Watching as a 13-year-old, the bit that really sticks in my mind is at the end of each episode when you'd say temporal disruption and everyone would freeze.
It was a very odd thing. I mean, the actual process of making it, we did it more like a string of sausages. That is to say, what you saw on the screen was what happened, but I used to top it and tail it because when we got enough time, which is basically how you make these programs, you know, I'd be told, "Okay, Hugo, we need to chop it here." And so I'd suddenly say, "Warning Team, temporal disruption approaching," and then they'd actually cut it, and then I'd put presumably freeze that picture, and then I'd say, "Temporal disruption complete," and that's how we'd do it, and then we'd carry on. I mean, sometimes the teams had to stay overnight because their game, you know, there's a lot of chaperoning, you can imagine, looking after children away from home. There's a lot of organisation, a lot of legal things you have to cover and so on and so forth. There's a lot of, and they can only work so long. And so when their hours are up, that's it. You have to send them off to a hotel or something and then complete their game the next day. So a lot of things like that you have to think about.
And I know that David Rowe did a lot of the artwork for the earlier series specifically. Did you not get to see the artwork before it went to live?
No, the first time I saw it. I mean, David was brilliant with this. I mean, I think he created the whole magic, certainly the early series, as you say, and I think he set the tone. Yes, his illustrations are incredible and wonderful, but even more complex than anybody realizes because, well, some of them had to be animated as well, you know, monsters and spiders and heaven knows what, war monsters and things like that. But they also had to be drawn to a particularly and very, very accurate perspective in a grid. Because the way this thing was done, there was one fixed camera and then other cameras doing close-ups and whatever and things. But the thing you mainly saw was from this fixed camera position. Because if it wasn't fixed and the illustrations weren't fixed in a perspective, then the floor would be in the wrong place, the doors would be in the... Do you know what I mean? People couldn't actually move within the computer-created space, realistically. So, I mean, I was absolutely amazed at David's work. I mean, it's fantastic and still is. I mean, he's brilliant.
Yeah, he did. He came to Play Expo Manchester with you. And looking at his work, it's so detailed. It's so good. He's very, very talented.
He is. He's very talented. But having to do it even more within that discipline of the perspective grid is just as stunning.
And did you prefer the earlier series when you were seen more as the fearsome sole presenter? Or did you like the addition of additional characters like Pickle and Lord Fear?
Well, I think that with the Pickle character, I think the idea was that we could comment on the action. It's very difficult to comment on the action on your own. So we could have the odd little comment about how they were doing or what they were doing and so on, which they would listen to and therefore get a clue as to what they should be doing. With Lord Fear, at first I wasn't terribly keen because I felt it kind of diminished what I was doing, which is an entirely selfish attitude, and I'm very sorry for it. But the truth is, he was a brilliant villain. He did add tremendously to it. And it did have to develop, and whether you like it or not, you know, had to develop. But it did take away from me that sort of a duality of character that I had before. I mean, I had to stop being at all menacing. But then, you know, that's fine. And Mark Knight, I mean, as Lord Fear was wonderful. I always remember one of his favourite lines. One of my favourite lines of his was he said something, "But I don't want to gloat." What am I saying? Of course I want to gloat. Which is wonderful. It's all ad-libbed. I mean, he was a tremendous ad-libber. I mean, he just came out with all sorts of stuff. Wonderful.
Now, you provided voice work for a lot of things since Nightmare. You've been in the Fable computer game as like a dungeon keeper. But you've also been in Doctor Who audiobooks, for example.
Yeah.
Is it as much fun to do voice work as it is to do acting roles?
No, I'm not really, no. I mean, if you're just doing sort of things for commercials or narrations, that's more of a strain than anything. There's a company called Big Finish I did a lot of stuff for, which was wonderful because they were spin-offs of television shows like Doctor Who and can't think what they're called now. Something of Steel.
Sapphire and Steel.
Sapphire and Steel, that's right. Things like that. They did audio things. They do still do audio things of that. And they're great because they're like radio drama. That's fun. As long as you turn the page. There's a famous old gag in radio. It's you're reading your lines. It says, "What's that in the road?" "Ahead." "Oh, damn." so yeah, they're fun. But yes, I mean, narrations are interesting. Usually because you've got to be very careful not to stumble over it and have the right emphasis on something so it doesn't, you know, you're not saying inferring the wrong thing. But I did one which really took me aback a bit. It was very long. I arrived at the studio and the director said, "Here we are, I'll give it to you. This is the diary of the Red Baron." And it was full of, as you could imagine, German names, German aircraft, German this, German that, German the other. And it was a very long piece. I mean, it's pages and pages and pages of this. Baron von Richthofen, that's it. Anyway, I started this thing and went through it. I must have taken 40 minutes or something. And, real concentration and trying to get all this stuff right, and hoping to God I'm getting all these names right and the right pronunciation. I got to the end of this, almost panting. The director said to me, "Righto, Hugo, we'll go for a take."
Oh.
I went, "What?" He was joking. He was putting my leg. He had it. Recorded. Yeah.
And you currently appear as a guest at conventions as well. How did that come about?
Purely by accident. I didn't even know these conventions existed, I have to say. Otherwise, I would have been in them a lot earlier. But it was, again, a childhood fan of Nightmare, who now grown up, was running these conventions. He was running one in Portsmouth, and he contacted me and said, "You know, please, I'd love you to come in." And so that's how I started it. And it's been great fun, and it's been wonderful meeting the public, my public, I have to say, Nightmare's public. Which, of course, I hadn't really ever met. And suddenly you meet people who really did love the show. And whilst we sort of knew at the time we were making something different, it was, you know, pushing the boundaries a bit, we didn't realise it would live. And we thought once it was over, that was it. So it's wonderful to meet all these people. I mean, people come up to me and say, "You made my childhood." And I feel, oh my gosh, you know, can I be retrospectively responsible for something? I mean... But also, you know, I had no idea that it had so much effect. probably because I was a child of radio, and you know, people talked to me about things that people my age talked to me about things they loved on television in their childhood. And of course, I wasn't really into that because we didn't have a television. So I didn't realize how much influence these sort of things could have. And it's wonderful to hear it. And people, a lot of people have gone into the gaming business or creating games or just playing them, or like these live-action role-play things. People have said to me, it's all through nightmare that I started doing this. So, yeah, it's fantastic.
Even nowadays, there's people going into it because of something that happened 30 years ago.
Oh, I know. And the astonishing thing is sometimes, 8 or 9-year-old boys usually come up and say, fantastic, it was a great show. And I think, how the devil do you know it? You weren't even born. but obviously, there are ways of still seeing it. Yes, I knew Challenge was doing, had repeated some. I think they've done the first 4 series. I don't know whether they'll ever do the next 4 or not. It'd be good if they did.
And I expect you get recognised so much in your conventions, but do you get recognised when you're out and about anywhere?
Not nowadays. I'm to the public, I'm smaller, fatter, older, greyer. And so they don't know, but I sometimes get the voice recognized still. As I say, I used to be recognized a lot in, I love Chinese food, so I used to go to Chinese restaurants a lot. And I was often recognized in Chinese restaurants because what else do they do at 5 o'clock? I mean, they're not serving food. They've done all the preparation. Well, they watch the telly, don't they? So they used to see Nightmare. That's why I got recognised. But the voice used to catch me out, yeah.
And also, speaking of conventions, we've noticed that you do occasionally make cameos in Nightmare Live as well.
Ah, Nightmare Live. Now, that's a great show. I recommend it to everybody. Want a good night. Even if you've never seen Nightmare, you'll have a lot of fun. Yes, they've asked me occasionally to do them, and I'll pop in. It's fun to do. I never know what's going to happen because they're totally improvised, I think. And they're not very good at briefing you. So you get on stage and wonder what on earth's going to happen. But there you go. It's great fun.
I didn't realise until I spoke to you at Manchester that you were in them and that you had little or no rehearsal as well. You just literally go on stage and just speak.
Oh, well, that's what Paul said to me once we were talking about it. And I said, he gave me a briefing what we're going to do briefly, a very, very brief briefing. And I said, so are we going to rehearse it? He said, you just have.
And do you have anything lined up in future?
No, I'm not so young. And so I'll do anything but opera and ballet, I tell myself, but I'm not really sure that I would. I think I've done with theatre, having done 50 years of it. It's not that I just like theatre. It's just that, I've lived out of a suitcase for a great deal of my life, and I rather like my home. And I think I got tired of living out of a suitcase, really, because, nobody builds a theatre at the end of your street. And if they did, they probably would only want you for one play, and that would be the end of it. So, I think I've done theatre now. I did 38 pantomimes, let alone all the plays and things, and I still occasionally get asked to do pantomime, but I don't think I want to do it anymore. No. Any nice movie where they put you up in a jolly good Winnebago and look after you, and television's quite nice, but theatre I think I've done with now.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for taking part.
Thank you. Thank you to everyone who's still interested in Nightmare and made my life so interesting in my old age. It's great. Thank you all. Thank you, Craig.
Who's that now? Hello? Not you again.
Hello, it's Mr. Mad here. I'll tell you who's mad, pal. I said I'll tell you who's mad.
Who?
Duncan Newmarch. That's who's mad. He thinks he's stuck in the 80s. Raving mad, pal.
Yes, thank you.
Stuck in the 80s. Duncan Newmarch.
By the way, did I tell you I was mad?
Spend an hour in the 80s. Duncan's there all the time.
Stuck in the 80s. Available now on... What's this? SoundCloud. What's SoundCloud? Is that a cassette?